Welcome to More Ghost Stories. You can always find us at www.moreghoststories.com. I'm J.B. Simeon, and I'm very happy to have you join me for this episode. In the 19th century, the British had a Christmas tradition of telling ghost stories. Family and friends would gather around the fireplace or at the dinner table and let the paranormal stories flow. In keeping with that tradition, I've chosen a Christmas ghost story to entertain you. During this episode, we will take a short commercial break. Then we will return to our story, and I promise you won't miss anything. Okay, let's begin.
The Water Ghost of Harrowby Hall by John Kendrick Bangs. Read by John Taylor. The trouble with Harrowby Hall was that it was haunted. What was worse, the ghost did not content itself with merely appearing at the bedside of the afflicted person who saw it, but persisted in remaining there for one mortal hour before it would disappear. It never appeared except on Christmas Eve, and then as the clock was striking 12, in which respect alone was it lacking in that originality which in these days is a sine qua non of success in spectral life. The owners of Harrowby Hall had done their utmost to rid themselves of the damp and dewy lady who rose up out of the best bedroom floor at midnight, but without avail. They had tried stopping the clock so that the ghost would not know when it was midnight, but she made her appearance just the same, with that fearful, miasmatic personality of hers. And there she would stand until everything about her was thoroughly saturated. Then the owners of Harrowby Hall cocked up every crack in the floor with the very best quality of hemp, and over this were placed layers of tar and canvas. The walls were made waterproof, and the doors and windows likewise, the proprietors having conceived the notion that the unexercised lady would find it difficult to leak into the room after these precautions had been taken. But even this did not suffice. The following Christmas Eve she appeared as promptly as before, and frightened the occupant of the room quite out of his senses by sitting down alongside of him and gazing with her cavernous blue eyes into his, and he noticed, too, that in her long, aqueously bony fingers, bits of dripping seaweed were entwined, the ends hanging down, and these ends she drew across his forehead until he became like one insane. And then he swooned away and was found unconscious in his bed the next morning by his host, simply saturated with seawater and fright, from the combined effects of which he never recovered, dying 4 years later of pneumonia and nervous prostration at the age of 78. The next year the master of Harrowby Hall decided not to have the best spare bedroom opened at all, thinking that perhaps the ghost's thirst for making herself disagreeable would be satisfied by haunting the furniture. But the plan was as unavailing as the many that had preceded it. The ghost appeared as usual in the room. That is, it was supposed she did, for the hangings were dripping wet the next morning, and in the parlor below the haunted room a great damp spot appeared on the ceiling. Finding no one there, she immediately set out to learn the reason why, and she chose none other to haunt than the owner of the Harrowby himself. She found him in his own cozy room, drinking whiskey undiluted, and felicitating himself upon having foiled her ghostship, when all of a sudden the curl went out of his hair, his whiskey bottle filled and overflowed, and he was himself in a condition similar to that of a man who has fallen into a water butt. When he recovered from the shock, which was a painful one, he saw before him the lady of the cavernous eyes and seaweed fingers. The sight was so unexpected and so terrifying that he fainted, but immediately came to, because of the vast amount of water in his hair, which, trickling down over his face, restored his consciousness. Now it so happened that the master of Harrowby was a brave man, and while he was not particularly fond of interviewing ghosts, especially such quenching ghosts as the one before him, he was not to be daunted by an apparition. He had paid the lady the compliment of feigning from the effects of his first surprise, and now that he had come to, he intended to find out a few things he felt he had a right to know. He would have liked to put on a dry suit of clothes first, but the apparition declined to leave him for an instant until her hour was up, and he was forced to deny himself that pleasure. Every time he would move, she would follow him, with the result that everything she came in contact with got a ducking. In an effort to warm himself up, he approached the fire, an unfortunate move, as it turned out, because it brought the ghost directly over the fire, which was immediately extinguished. The whiskey became utterly valueless as a comforter to his chilled system, because it was by this time diluted to a proportion of 90% of water. The only thing he could do to ward off the evil effects of his encounter he did, and that was to swallow 10 2-grain quinine pills, which he managed to put into his mouth before the ghost had time to interfere. Having done this, he turned with some asperity to the ghost and said, "Far be it from me to be impolite to a woman, madam, but I'm hanged if it wouldn't please me better if you'd stop these infernal visits of yours to this house. Go sit out on the lake if you like that sort of thing. Soak the water butt if you wish, but do not, I implore you, come into a gentleman's house and saturate him and his possessions in this way. It is damned disagreeable." "Henry Hartwick Oglethorpe," said the ghost in a gurgling voice, "you don't know what you are talking about." "Madam," returned the unhappy householder, "I wish that remark was strictly truthful. I was talking about you. It would be shillings and pence, nay, pounds in my pocket, madam, if I did not know of you." "That is a bit of specious nonsense," returned the ghost, throwing a quart of indignation into the face of the master of Harrowby. "It may rank as high as repartee, but as a comment upon my statement that you do not know what you are talking about, it savors of irrelevant impertinence. You do not know that I am compelled to haunt this place year after year by inexorable fate. It is no pleasure to me to enter this house and ruin and mildew everything I touch. I never aspired to be a shower bath, but it is my doom. Do you know who I am?" "No, I don't," returned the master of Harrowby. "I should say you were the Lady of the Lake, or Little Sally Waters." "You are a witty man for your years," said the ghost. "Well, my humor is drier than yours will ever be," returned the master. "No doubt. I am never dry. I am the water ghost of Harrowby Hall, and dryness is a quality entirely beyond my wildest hope. I have been the incumbent of this highly unpleasant office for 200 years tonight." "How the deuce did you ever come to get elected?" asked the master. "Through a suicide," replied the spectre. "I am the ghost of that fair maiden whose picture hangs over the mantelpiece in the drawing-room. I should have been your great-great-great-great-great-aunt if I had lived, Henry Hartwick Oglethorpe, for I was the own sister of your great-great-great-great-grandfather. But what induced you to get this house into such a predicament?" "I was not to blame, sir," returned the lady. "It was my father's fault. He it was who built Harrowby Hall, and the haunted chamber was to have been mine. My father had it furnished in pink and yellow, knowing well that blue and gray formed the only combination of color I could tolerate. He did it merely to spite me, and with what I deem a proper spirit, I declined to live in the room, whereupon my father said I could live there or on the lawn, he didn't care which. That night I ran from the house and jumped over the cliff into the sea." "That was rash," said the master of Harrowby. "So I've heard," returned the ghost. "If I had known what the consequences were to be, I should not have jumped. But I never really realized what I was doing until after I was drowned. I had been drowned a week when a sea nymph came to me and informed me that I was to be one of her followers for ever afterwards, adding that it should be my doom to haunt Harrowby Hall for 1 hour every Christmas Eve throughout the rest of eternity. I was to haunt that room on such Christmas Eves as I found it inhabited, and if it should turn out not to be inhabited, I was, and am, to spend the allotted hour with the head of the house. I'll sell the place. That you cannot do, for it is also required of me that I shall appear as the deeds are to be delivered to any purchaser and divulge to him the awful secret of the house. Do you mean to tell me that on every Christmas Eve that I don't happen to have somebody in that guest chamber, you are going to haunt me wherever I may be, ruining my whiskey, taking all the curl out of my hair, extinguishing my fire, and soaking me through to the skin? Demanded the master. You have stated the case, Oglethorpe, and what is more, said the water ghost, it doesn't make the slightest difference where you are. If I find that room empty, wherever you may be, I shall douse you with my spectral pres— Here the clock struck one, and immediately the apparition faded away. It was perhaps more of a trickle than a fade, but as a disappearance it was complete. By St. George and his dragon, ejaculated the master of Harrowby, wringing his hands, it is guineas to hot cross buns that next Christmas there's an occupant of the spare room, or I spend the night in a bathtub. But the master of Harrowby would have lost his wager had there been anyone there to take him up, for when Christmas Eve came again, he was in his grave, never having recovered from the cold contracted that awful night. Harrowby Hall was closed, and the heir to the estate was in London, where to him, in his chambers, came the same experience that his father had gone through, saving only that, being younger and stronger, he survived the shock. Everything in his rooms was ruined. His clocks were rusted in the works. A fine collection of watercolor drawings was entirely obliterated by the onslaught of the water ghost, and what was worse, the apartments below his were drenched with the water soaking through the floors, a damage for which he was compelled to pay, and which resulted in his being requested by his landlady to vacate the premises immediately. The story of the visitation inflicted upon his family had gone abroad, and no one could be got to invite him out to any function save afternoon teas and receptions. Fathers of daughters declined to permit him to remain in their houses later than 8 o'clock at night, not knowing but that some emergency might arise in the supernatural world which would require the unexpected appearance of the water ghost in this on nights other than Christmas Eve, and before the mystic hour when weary churchyards, ignoring the rules which are supposed to govern polite society, began to yawn. Nor would the maids themselves have aught to do with him, fearing the destruction by the sudden incursion of aqueous femininity of the costumes which they held most dear. So the heir of Harrowby Hall resolved, as his ancestors for several generations before him had resolved, that something must be done. His first thought was to make one of his servants occupy the haunted rooms at the crucial moment, but in this he tailed, because the servants themselves knew the history of that room and rebelled. None of his friends would consent to sacrifice their personal comfort to his, nor was there to be found in all of England a man so poor as to be willing to occupy the doomed chamber on Christmas Eve for pay. Then the thought came to the heir to have the fireplace in the room enlarged, so that he might evaporate the ghost at its first appearance, and he was felicitating himself upon the ingenuity of his plan when he remembered what his father had told him, how that no fire could withstand the lady's extremely contagious dampness. And then he bethought him of steam pipes. These, he remembered, could lie hundreds of feet deep in water and still retain sufficient heat to drive the water away in a vapor. And, as a result of this, thought the haunted room was heated by steam to a withering degree, and the heir for 6 months attended daily the Turkish baths, so that when Christmas Eve came he could himself withstand the awful temperature of the room. The scheme was only partially successful. The water ghost appeared at the specified time and found the heir of Harrowby prepared, but hot as the room was, it shortened her visit by no more than 5 minutes in the hour, during which time the nervous system of the young master was well nigh shattered, and the room itself was cracked and warped to an extent which required the outlay of a large sum of money to remedy. And worse than this, as the last drop of the water ghost was slowly sizzling itself out on the floor, she whispered to her would-be conqueror that his scheme would avail him nothing, because there was still water in great plenty where she came from, and that next year would find her rehabilitated and as exasperatingly saturating as ever. It was then that the natural action of the mind, in going from one extreme to the other, suggested to the ingenious heir of Harrowby the means by which the water ghost was ultimately conquered, and happiness once more came within the grasp of the house of Oglethorpe. The heir provided himself with a warm suit of fur underclothing. Donning this with the furry side in, he placed over it a rubber garment, tight-fitting, which he wore just as a woman wears a jersey. On top of this he placed another set of underclothing, this suit made of wool, and over this was a second rubber garment like the first. Upon his head he placed a light and comfortable diving helmet, and so clad on the following Christmas Eve he awaited the coming of his tormentor. It was a bitterly cold night that brought to a close this 24th day of December. The air outside was still, but the temperature was below zero. Within all was quiet, the servants of Harrowby Hall awaiting with beating hearts the outcome of their master's campaign against his supernatural visitor. The master himself was lying on the bed in the haunted room, clad, as has already been indicated, and then the clock clanged out the hour of 12. There was a sudden banging of doors, a blast of cold air swept through the halls, the door leading into the haunted chamber flew open, a splash was heard, and the water ghost was seen standing at the side of the heir of Harrowby, from whose outer dress there streamed rivulets of water, but whose own person, deep down under the various garments he wore, was as dry and as warm as he could have wished. "Ha!" said the young master of Harrowby, "I'm glad to see you." "You are the most original man I've met, if that is true," returned the ghost. "May I ask where did you get that hat?" "Certainly, madam," returned the master courteously. "It is a little portable observatory I had made for just such emergencies as this. But tell me, is it true that you are doomed to follow me about for one mortal hour, to stand where I stand, to sit where I sit?" "That is my delectable fate," returned the lady. "Well, go out on the lake," said the master, starting up. "You can't get rid of me that way," returned the ghost. "The water won't swallow me up. In fact, it will just add to my present bulk." "Nevertheless," said the master firmly, "we will go out on the lake." "But, my dear sir," returned the ghost, with a pale reluctance, "it is fearfully cold out there. You will be frozen hard before you've been out 10 minutes." "Oh, no, I'll not," replied the master. "I am very warmly dressed. Come." This last in a tone of command that made the ghost ripple. And they started. They had not gone far before the water ghost showed signs of distress. "You walk too slowly," she said. "I am nearly frozen. My knees are so stiff now I can hardly move. I beseech you to accelerate your step." "I should like to oblige a lady," returned the master courteously, "but my clothes are rather heavy, and 100 yards an hour is about my speed. Indeed, I think we would better sit down here on the snowdrift and talk matters over." Do not do so, I beg," cried the ghost. "Let me move on. I feel myself growing rigid as it is. If we stop here, I shall be frozen stiff." "That, madam," said the master slowly, and seating himself on an ice cake, "that is why I have brought you here. We have been on this spot just 10 minutes. We have 50 more. Take your time about it, madam, but freeze. That is all I ask of you." "I cannot move my right leg now," cried the ghost in despair, "and my overskirt is a solid sheet of ice. Oh, good, kind Mr. Oglethorpe, light a fire and let me go free from these icy fetters." "Never, madam. It cannot be. I have you at last." "Alas!" cried the ghost, a tear trickling down her frozen cheek. "Help me, I beg, I congeal." "Congeal, madam, congeal," returned Oglethorpe coldly. "You have drenched me and mine for 203 years, madam. Tonight you have had your last drench." "Ah, but I shall thaw out again, and then you'll see, instead of the comfortably tepid, genial ghost I have been in my past, sir, I shall be iced water," cried the lady threateningly. "No, you won't either," returned Oglethorpe. "For when you are frozen quite stiff, I shall send you to a cold storage warehouse, and there you shall remain an icy work of art for evermore." "But warehouses burn." "So they do, but this warehouse cannot burn. It is made of asbestos, and surrounding it are fireproof walls, and within those walls the temperature is now, and shall forever be, 416 degrees below the 0 point. Low enough to make an icicle of any flame in this world or the next," the master added with an ill-suppressed chuckle. "For the last time, I beseech you, I would go on my knees to you, Oglethorpe, were they not already frozen. I beg of you, do not do..." Here, even the words froze on the water ghost's lips, and the clock struck one. There was a momentary tremor throughout the ice-bound form, and the moon, coming out from behind a cloud, shone down on the rigid figure of a beautiful woman sculptured in clear, transparent ice. There stood the ghost of Harrowby Hall, conquered by the cold, a prisoner for all time. The heir of Harrowby Hall had won at last, and today, in a large storage house in London, stands the frigid form of one who will never again flood the house of Oglethorpe with woe and seawater. As for the heir of Harrowby, his success in coping with a ghost has made him famous, a fame that still lingers about him, although his victory took place some 20 years ago. And so, far from being unpopular with a fair sex, as he was when we first knew him, he has not only been married twice, but is to lead a third bride to the altar when the year is out. End of The Water Ghost of Harrowby Hall.
All right, that concludes our episode. If you would like to comment on the story in this episode, please email me at feedback@moreghoststories.com. Next, if you enjoy More Ghost Stories, please help us grow the community by letting your friends and family know. It's easy to do that by going to the www.moreghoststories.com website and locating the story that you want to hear on the front page and pressing play. It's that simple. This concludes the show. Thank you for listening. I'm J.B. Simeon, and I'll see you next week with a new episode. Until then, be aware, be cautious, and take care. Welcome to More Ghost Stories. You can always find us at www.moreghoststories.com. I'm J.B. Simeon, and I'm very happy to have you join me for this episode. In the 19th century, the British had a Christmas tradition of telling ghost stories. Family and friends would gather around the fireplace or at the dinner table and let the paranormal stories flow. In keeping with that tradition, I've chosen a Christmas ghost story to entertain you. During this episode, we will take a short commercial break. Then we will return to our story, and I promise you won't miss anything. Okay, let's begin.
The Marble Child by E. Nesbitt. All over the pavement of the church spread the exaggerated cross-hatching of the old pew's oak, a Smithfield market of intersecting lines such as children made with cards in the old days when kings and knaves had fat legs bulging above their serviceable feet, and queens had skirts to their gowns and were not cut across their royal middles by mirrors reflecting only the bedizened torso of them and the charge, heart trefoil or the like, in the right-hand top corner of the oblong that framed them. The pews had qualities: tall, fat hassocks, red cushions, a comparative seclusion, and, in the case of the affluent, red curtains drawn at sermon time. The child, wearied by the spectacle of a plump divine in black gown and Geneva bands, thumping the pulpit cushions in the madness of incomprehensible oratory, surrendered his ears to the noise of intonations which, in his own treble, would have earned the reprimand naughty temper. His eyes, however, were, through some oversight of the gods of his universe, still his own. They found their own pasture, not, to be sure, the argent and sable of gowns and bands, still less the gules of flushed denunciatory gills. There is a fair pasture in an old church, which, when Norman work was broken down, men loved and built again as from the heart, with pillars and arches, which, to their rude time, symbolized all that the heart desires to materialize in symbolic stone. The fretted tombs where the effigies of warrior and priest lay lifelike in dead marble, the fretted canopies that brooded above their rest, tall pillars like the trunks of the pine woods that smelt so sweet, the marvel of the timbered roof, turned upside down, it would be like a ship. And what could be easier than to turn it upside down? Imagination shrank bashfully from the pulpit already tightly tenanted, but the triforium was plainly and beautifully empty. There one could walk, squeezing happily through the deep thin arches, and treading carefully by the unguarded narrow ledge. Only, if one played too long in the roof, aunts nudged and urgent whispers insisted that one must not look about like that in church. When this moment came, it came always as a crisis foreseen, half dreaded, half longed for. After that, the child kept his eyes lowered and looked only at the faded red hassocks from which the straw bulged, and in brief guarded intimate moments, at the other child. The other child was kneeling always, whether the congregation knelt or stood or sat. Its hands were clasped, its face was raised, but its back bowed under a weight, the weight of the font, for the other child was of marble and knelt always in the church Sundays and weekdays. There had been once three marble figures holding up the shallow basin, but two had crumbled or been broken away, and now it seemed that the whole weight of the superimposed marble rested on those slender shoulders. The child who was not marble was sorry for the other. He must be very tired. The child who was not marble, his name was Ernst, that child of weary eyes and bored brain, pitied the marble boy while he envied him. "I suppose he doesn't really feel if he's stone," he said. "That's what they mean by the stony-hearted tyrant. But if he does feel, how jolly it would be if he could come out and sit in my pew, or if I could creep under the font beside him. If he would move a little, there would be just room for me." The first time that Ernst ever saw the marble child move was on the hottest Sunday in the year. The walk across the fields had been a breathless penance. The ground burned the soles of Ernst's feet as red-hot ploughshares the feet of saints. The corn was cut and stood in stiff yellow stooks, and the shadows were very black. The sky was light, except in the west beyond the pine trees where blue-black clouds were piled. "Like witches' feather beds," said Aunt Harriet, shaking out the folds of her lace shawl. "Not before the child, dear," whispered Aunt Emmeline. Ernst heard her, of course. It was always like that. As soon as anyone spoke about anything interesting, Aunt Emmeline intervened. Ernst walked along, very melancholy in his starched frill. The dust had whitened his strapped shoes, and there was a wrinkle in one of his white socks. "Pull it up, child, pull it up," said Aunt Jessie, and shielded from the world by the vast silk-veiled crinolines of three full-sized aunts, he pulled it up. On the way to church, and indeed in all walks abroad, you held the hand of an aunt. The circumferent crinolines made holding an arm's-length business very tiring. Ernst was always glad when, in the porch, the hand was dropped. It was just as the porch was reached that the first lonely roll of thunder broke over the hills. "I knew it," said Aunt Jessie in triumph, "but you would wear your blue silk." There was no more thunder till after the second lesson, which was hardly ever as interesting as the first, Ernst thought. The marble child looked more tired than usual, and Ernst lost himself in a dream game where both of them got out from prison and played hide-and-seek among the tombstones. Then the thunder cracked deafeningly right over the church. Ernst forgot to stand up, and even the clergyman waited till it died away. It was a most exciting service, well worth coming to church for, and afterwards people crowded in the wide porch and wondered whether it would clear, and wished they had brought their umbrellas. Some went back and sat in their pews till the servants should have had time to go home and return with umbrellas and cloaks. The more impetuous made clumsy rushes between the showers, bonnets bent, skirts held well up. Many a Sunday dress was ruined that day, many a bonnet fell from best to second best. And it was when Aunt Jessie whispered to him to sit still and be a good boy and learn a hymn, that he looked to the marble child with, "Isn't it a shame?" in his heart and his eyes, and the marble child looked back, "Never mind, it will soon be over," and held out its marble hands. Ernst saw them come toward him, reaching well beyond the rim of the basin under which they had always, till now, stayed. "Oh!" said Ernst quite out loud, and dropping the hymn-book held out his hands, or began to hold them out, for before he had done more than sketch the gesture, he remembered that marble does not move, and that one must not be silly. All the same, marble had moved. Also, Ernst had spoken out loud in church. Unspeakable disgrace. He was taken home in conscious ignominy, treading in all the puddles to distract his mind from his condition. He was put to bed early as a punishment, instead of sitting up and learning his catechism under the charge of one of the maids, while the aunts went to evening church. This, while it was terrible to Ernst, was in the nature of a reprieve to the housemaid, who found means to modify her own consequent loneliness. Faraway whispers and laughs from the back or kitchen windows assured Ernst that the front or polite side of the house was unguarded. He got up, simulated the appearance of the completely dressed, and went down the carpeted stairs, through the rosewood-furnished drawing-room, rose-scented and still as a deathbed, and so out through the French windows to the lawn, where already the beginnings of dew lay softly. His going out had no definite aim. It was simply an act of rebellion, such as, secure from observation, the timid may achieve, a demonstration akin to putting the tongue out behind people's backs. Having got himself out on the lawn, he made haste to hide in the shrubbery, disheartened by a baffling consciousness of the futility of safe revenges. What is the tongue put out behind the back of the enemy without the applause of some admirer? The red rays of the setting sun made splendor in the dripping shrubbery. "I wish I hadn't," said Ernst. But it seemed silly to go back now, just to go out and to go back, so he went farther into the shrubbery and got out at the other side where the shrubbery slopes down into the wood, and it was nearly dark there, so nearly that the child felt more alone than ever. And then quite suddenly he was not alone. Hands parted the hazels, and a face he knew looked out from between them. He knew the face, and yet the child he saw was not any of the children he knew. "Well?" said the child with the face he knew. "I've been watching you. What did you come out for?" "I was put to bed." "Do you not like it?" "Not when it's for punishment." "If you'll go back now," said the strange child, "I'll come and play with you after you're asleep." "You daren't! Suppose the aunts catch you!" "They won't," said the child, shaking its head and laughing. "I'll race you to the house." Ernst ran. He won the race, for the other child was not there at all when he reached the house. "How odd!" he said. But he was tired, and there was thunder again, and it was beginning to rain large spots as big as pennies on the steps of the French window. So he went back to bed, too sleepy to worry about the question of where he had seen the child before, and only a little disappointed because his revenge had been so brief and inadequate. Then he fell asleep, and dreamed that the marble child had crept out from under the font, and that he and it were playing hide-and-seek among the pews in the gallery at church. It was a delightful dream, and lasted all night, and when he woke he knew that the child he had seen in the woods in yesterday's last light was the marble child from the church. This did not surprise him as much as it would surprise you. The world where children live is so full of amazing and incredible-looking things that turn out to be quite real, and if Lot's wife could be turned into a pillar of salt, why should not a marble child turn into a real one? It was all quite plain to Ernst, but he did not tell anyone because he had a feeling that it might not be easy to make it plain to them. "That child doesn't look quite the thing," said Aunt Emmeline at breakfast. "A dose of Gregory's, I think, at 11." Ernst Morning was blighted. "Did you ever take Gregory's powder? It is worse than quinine, worse than senna, worse than anything except castor oil." But Ernst had to take it, in raspberry jam. "And don't make such faces," said Aunt Emmeline, rinsing the spoon at the pantry sink. "You know it's all for your own good." As if the thought that it is for one's own good ever kept anyone from making faces. The aunts were kind in their grown-up, crinolined way, but Ernst wanted someone to play with. Every night in his dreams he played with the marble child, and at church on Sunday the marble child still held out its hands farther than before. "Come along, then," Ernst said to it, in that voice with which the heart speaks to heart. "Come and sit with me behind the red curtains. Come!" The marble child did not look at him. Its head seemed to be bent farther forward than ever before. When it came to the second hymn, Ernst had an inspiration. All the rest of the churchful, sleepy and suitable, were singing, "The roseate hues of early dawn, the brightness of the day, the crimson of the sunset sky, how fast they fade away." Ernst turned his head toward the marble child and softly mouthed, you could hardly call it singing, "The roseate hues of early dawn, the brightness of the day, come out, come out, come out, come out, come out with me and play." And he pictured the rapture of that moment when the marble child should respond to this appeal, creep out from under the font, and come and sit beside him on the red cushions beyond the red curtains. The aunts would not see, of course. They never saw the things that mattered. No one would see except Ernst. He looked hard at the marble child. "You must come out," he said, and again, "You must come, you must!" And the marble child did come. It crept out and came to sit by him, holding his hand. It was a cold hand, certainly, but it did not feel like marble. And the next thing he knew, an aunt was shaking him and whispering with fierceness tempered by reverence for the sacred edifice, "Wake up, Ernst! How can you be so naughty?" And the marble child was back in its place under the font. When Ernst looks back on that summer, it seems to have thundered every time he went to church, but of course this cannot really have been the case. But it was certainly a very lowering, purple-skied day which saw him stealthily start on the adventure of his little life. He was weary of aunts. They were kind, yet just. They told him so, and he believed them, but their justice was exactly like other people's nagging, and their kindness he did not want at all. He wanted someone to play with. "May we walk up to the churchyard?" was a request at first received graciously as showing a serious spirit. But its reiteration was considered morbid, and his walks took the more dusty direction of the county asylum. His longing for the only child he knew, the marble child, exacerbated by denial, drove him to rebellion. He would run away. He would live with the marble child in the big church porch. They would eat berries from the wood nearby, just as children did in books, and hide there when people came to church. So he watched his opportunity and went quietly out through the French window, skirted the side of the house where all the windows were blank because of the old window tax, took the narrow strip of lawn at a breathless run, and found safe cover among the rhododendrons. The church door was locked, of course, but he knew where there was a broken pane in the vestry window, and his eye had marked the lopsided tombstone underneath it. By climbing upon that and getting a knee in the carved waterspout, he did it, got his hand through, turned the catch of the window, and fell through upon the dusty table of the vestry. The door was ajar, and he passed into the empty church. It seemed very large and grey now that he had it to himself. His feet made a loud echoing noise that was disconcerting. He had meant to call out, "Here I am," but in the face of these echoes he could not. He found the marble child, its head bent more than ever, its hands reaching out quite beyond the edge of the font, and when he was quite close he whispered, "Here I am. Come and play." But his voice trembled a little. The marble child was so plainly marble, and yet it had not always been marble. He was not sure, yet. "I am sure," he said. "You did talk to me in the shrubbery, didn't you?" But the marble child did not move or speak. "You did come and hold my hand last Sunday," he said a little louder, and only the empty echoes answered him. "Come out," he said then, almost afraid now of the church's insistent silence. "I've come to live with you altogether. Come out of your marble. Do come out." He reached up to stroke the marble cheek. A sound thrilled him, a loud, everyday sound. The big key turning in the lock of the south door. The aunts. "Now they'll take me back," said Ernst. "You might have come." But it was not the aunts. It was the old pew-opener come to scrub the chancel. She came slowly in with pail and brush. The pail slopped a little water onto the floor close to Ernst as she passed him, not seeing. Then the marble child moved, turned toward Ernst with speaking lips and eyes that saw. "You can stay with me forever if you like," it said. "But you'll have to see things happen. I have seen things happen." "What sort of things?" Ernst asked. "Terrible things." "What things shall I have to see?" "Her." The marble child moved a free arm to point to the old woman on the chancel steps. "And your aunt, who will be here presently looking for you. Do you hear the thunder? Presently the lightning will strike the church. It won't hurt us, but it will fall on them." Ernst remembered in a flash how kind Aunt Emmeline had been when he was ill, how Aunt Jessie had given him his chessmen, and Aunt Harriet had taught him how to make paper rosettes for picture frames. "I must go and tell them," he said. "If you go, you'll never see me again," said the marble child, and put its arms around his neck. "Can't I come back to you when I've told them?" Ernst asked, returning the embrace. "There will be no coming back," said the marble child. "But I want you. I love you best of everybody in the world," Ernst said. "I know." "I'll stay with you," said Ernst. The marble child said nothing. "But if I don't tell them, I shall be the same as a murderer," Ernst whispered. "Oh, let me go and come back to you." "I shall not be here." "But I must go. I must," said Ernst, torn between love and duty. "Yes." "And I shan't have you any more?" the living child urged. "You shall have me in your heart," said the marble child. "That's where I want to be. That's my real home." They kissed each other again. It was certainly a direct providence, Aunt Emmeline used to say in latter years to really sympathetic friends, "that I thought of going up to the church when I did. Otherwise nothing could have saved dear Ernst. He was terrified, quite crazed with fright, poor child, and he rushed out at me from behind our pew, shouting, 'Come away, auntie, come away,' and dragged me out. Mrs. Meadows providentially followed to see what it was all about, and the next thing was the catastrophe." "The church was struck by a thunderbolt, was it not?" the sympathetic friend asks. "It was indeed. A deafening crash, my dear, and then the church slowly crumbled before our eyes. The south wall broke like a slice of cake when you break it across, and the noise and the dust. Mrs. Meadows never had her hearing again, poor thing, and her mind was a little affected, too. I became unconscious, and Ernst, well, it was altogether too much for the child. He lay between life and death for weeks. Shock to the system, the physician said. He had been rather run down before. We had to get a little cousin to come and live with us afterwards. The physician said that he required young society. It must indeed have been a shock, says the sympathetic friend, who knows there is more to come. His intellect was quite changed, my dear, Aunt Emmeline resumes. On regaining consciousness, he demanded the marble child. Cried and raved, my dear, always about the marble child. It appeared he had had fancies about one of the little angels that supported the old font. Not the present font, my dear. We presented that as a token of gratitude to Providence for our escape. Of course we checked his fancifulness as well as we could, but it lasted quite a long time. What became of the little marble angel, the friend inquires, as in friendship bound. Crushed to powder, dear, in the awful wreck of the church, not a trace of it could be found, and poor Mrs. Meadows, so dreadful those delusions. What form did her delusions take? The friend, anxious to be done with the old story, hastily asks. Well, she always declared that two children ran out to warn me, and that one of them was very unusual-looking. It wasn't no flesh and blood, ma'am, she used to say in her ungrammatical way. It was a little angel that taken care of Master Ernst. It had hold of his hand, and I say it was his garden angel, and its face was as bright as a lily in the sun. The friend glances at the India cabinet, and Aunt Emmeline rises and unlocks it. Ernst must have been behaving in a very naughty and destructive way in the church, but the physician said he was not quite himself, probably, for when they got him home and undressed him, they found this in his hand. Then the sympathizing friend polishes her glasses and looks, not for the first time, at the relic from the drawer of the India cabinet. It is a white marble finger. Thus flow the reminiscences of Aunt Emmeline. The memories of Ernst run as this tale runs.
All right, that concludes our episode. If you would like to comment on the story in this episode, please email me at feedback@moreghoststories.com. Next, if you enjoy More Ghost Stories, please help us grow the community by letting your friends and family know. It's easy to do that by going to the www.moreghoststories.com website and locating the story that you want to hear on the front page and pressing play. It's that simple. This concludes the show. Thank you for listening. I'm J.B. Simeon, and I'll see you next week with a new episode. Until then, be aware, be cautious, and take care. Welcome to More Ghost Stories. You can always find us at www.moreghoststories.com. I'm J.B. Simeon, and I'm very happy to have you join me for this episode. In the 19th century, the British had a Christmas tradition of telling ghost stories. Family and friends would gather around the fireplace or at the dinner table and let the paranormal stories flow. In keeping with that tradition, I've chosen a Christmas ghost story to entertain you. During this episode, we will take a short commercial break. Then we will return to our story, and I promise you won't miss anything. Okay, let's begin.
Lost Hearts by M.R. James. Reading by David Lewis Richardson. It was, as far as I can ascertain, in September of the year 1811, that a post-chaise drew up before the door of Aswoby Hall, in the heart of Lincolnshire. The little boy, who was the only passenger in the chaise, and who jumped out as soon as it had stopped, looked about him with the keenest curiosity during the short interval that elapsed between the ringing of the bell and the opening of the hall door. He saw a tall, square, red-brick house, built in the reign of Anne. A stone-pillared porch had been added in the pure classical style of 1790. The windows of the house were many, tall and narrow, with small panes and thick white woodwork. A pediment pierced with a round window crowned the front. There were wings to right and left, connected by curious glazed galleries, supported by colonnades with the central block. These wings plainly contained the stables and offices of the house. Each was surmounted by an ornamental cupola with a gilded vane. An evening light shone on the building, making the window panes glow like so many fires. Away from the hall, in front, stretched a flat park studded with oak and fringed with firs, which stood out against the sky. The clock in the church tower, buried in trees on the edge of the park, only its golden weathercock catching the light, was striking six, and the sound came gently beating down the wind. It was altogether a pleasant impression, though tinged with the sort of melancholy appropriate to an evening in early autumn that was conveyed to the mind of the boy who was standing in the porch, waiting for the door to open to him. The postchaise had brought him from Warwickshire, where, some 6 months before, he had been left an orphan. Now, owing to the generous offer of his elderly cousin, Mr. Abney, he had come to live at Aswerby. The offer was unexpected, because all who knew anything about Mr. Abney looked upon him as a somewhat austere recluse, into whose steady-going household the advent of a small boy would import a new and, it seemed, incongruous element. The truth is that very little was known of Mr. Abney's pursuits or temper. The professor of Greek at Cambridge had been heard to say that no one knew more of the religious beliefs of the latter pagans than did the owner of Aswerby. Certainly his library contained all the then available books bearing on the mysteries, the Orphic poems, the worship of Mithras, and the Neoplatonists. In the marble-paved hall stood a fine group of Mithras slaying a bull, which had been imported from the Levant at great expense by the owner. He had contributed a description of it to the Gentleman's Magazine, and he had written a remarkable series of articles in the Critical Museum on the superstitions of the Romans of the Lower Empire. He was looked upon, in fine, as a man wrapped up in his books, and it was a matter of great surprise among his neighbours that he should ever have heard of his orphan cousin Stephen Elliot, much more that he should have volunteered to make him an inmate of Aswerby Hall. Whatever may have been expected by his neighbours, it is certain that Mr. Abney, the tall, the thin, the austere, seemed inclined to give his young cousin a kindly reception. The moment the front door was opened, he darted out of his study, rubbing his hands with delight. "How are you, my boy? How are you? How old are you?" said he. "That is, you are not too much tired, I hope, by your journey to eat your supper?"
"No, thank you, sir," said Master Elliot. "I am pretty well."
"That's good, lad," said Mr. Abney. "And how old are you, my boy?" It seemed a little odd that he should have asked the question twice in the first 2 minutes of their acquaintance.
"I'm 12 years old next birthday, sir," said Stephen.
"And when is your birthday, my dear boy?"
11th of September, eh?
That's well, that's very well. Nearly a year hence, isn't it?
I like to get these things down in my book."
"Sure it's 12. Certain?"
"Yes, quite sure, sir."
"Well, well, take him to Mrs. Bunch's room, Parks, and let him have his tea, supper, whatever it is."
"Yes, sir," answered the staid Mr. Parks, and conducted Stephen to the lower regions. Mrs. Bunch was the most comfortable and human person whom Stephen had as yet met at Aswerby. She made him completely at home. They were great friends in a quarter of an hour, and great friends they remained. Mrs. Bunch had been born in the neighbourhood some 55 years before the date of Stephen's arrival, and her residence at the Hall was of 20 years' standing. Consequently, if anyone knew the ins and outs of the house and the district, Mrs. Bunch knew them, and she was by no means disinclined to communicate her information. Certainly there were plenty of things about the Hall and the Hall gardens which Stephen, who was of an adventurous and inquiring turn, was anxious to have explained to him.
"Who built the temple at the end of the laurel walk? Who was the old man whose picture hung on the staircase sitting at a table with a skull underneath his hand?"
These and many similar points were cleared up by the resources of Mrs. Bunch's powerful intellect. There were others, however, of which the explanations furnished were less satisfactory. One November evening, Stephen was sitting by the fire in the housekeeper's room, reflecting on his surroundings.
"Is Mr. Abney a good man? And will he go to heaven?" he suddenly asked with the peculiar confidence which children possess in the ability of their elders to settle these questions, the decision of which is believed to be reserved for other tribunals.
"Good
bless the child," said Mrs. Punch. "Master's as kind a soul as ever I see. Didn't I never tell you of the little boy as he took in out of the street, as you may say, this 7 years back? And the little girl, 2 years after I first come here. No, do tell me about them, Mrs. Bunch, now, this minute."
"Well,"
said Mrs. Bunch, "the little girl I don't seem to recollect so much about. I know Master brought her back with him from his walk one day, and give orders to Mrs. Ellis, as was housekeeper then, as she should be took every care with, and the poor child had no one belonging to her. She told me so her own self, and here she lived with us, a matter of 3 weeks it might be, and then, whether she were something of a gypsy in her blood or what not, but one morning she out of her bed afore any of us had opened her eye, and neither track nor trace of her have I set eyes on since. Master was wonderful put about, and had all the bonds dragged, but it's my belief she was had away by them gypsies, for there was singing around the house for as much as an hour the night she went, and Parks, he declares he heard them a-calling in the woods all that afternoon. Dear, dear, a hot child she was, so silent in her ways and all, but I was wonderful taken up with her. So domesticated she was, surprising. And what about the little boy?"
said Stephen.
"Oh, that poor boy," sighed Mrs. Bunch. "He were a foreigner, Jevney he called hisself, and he come a-tweaking his hurdy-gurdy round and about the drive one winter day, and Master had him in that minute, and asked him all about where he came from, and how old he was, and how he made his way, and where was his relatives, and all as kind as heart could wish. But it went the same way with him, that a unruly lot them foreign nations, I do suppose, and he was off one fine morning just the same as the girl. Why he went, and what he done, was our question for as much as a year after. For he never took his hurdy-gurdy, and there it lays on the shelf."
The remainder of the evening was spent by Stephen in miscellaneous cross-examination of Mrs. Bunch, and in efforts to extract a tune from the hurdy-gurdy. That night he had a curious dream. At the end of the passage at the top of the house in which his bedroom was situated, there was an old disused bathroom. It was kept locked, but the upper half of the door was glazed, and, since the muslin curtains which used to hang there had long been gone, you could look in and see the lead-lined bath affixed to the wall on the right hand, with its head towards the window. On the night of which I am speaking, Stephen Elliot found himself, as he thought, looking through the glazed door. The moon was shining through the window, and he was gazing at a figure which lay in the bath. His description of what he saw reminds me of what I once beheld myself in the famous vault of St. Michan's Church in Dublin, which possesses the horrid property of preserving corpses from decay for centuries. A figure, inexpressibly thin and pathetic, of a dusty leaden colour, enveloped in a shroud-like garment, the thin lips crooked into a faint and dreadful smile, the hands pressed tightly over the region of the heart. As he looked upon it, a distant, almost inaudible moan seemed to issue from its lips, and the arms began to stir. The terror of the sight forced Stephen backwards, and he awoke to the fact that he was indeed standing on the cold boarded floor of the passage in the full light of the moon. With a courage which I do not think can be common among boys of his age, he went to the door of the bathroom to ascertain if the figure of his dreams were really there. It was not, and he went back to bed. Mrs. Bunch was much impressed next morning by his story, and went so far as to replace the muslin curtain over the glazed door of the bathroom. Mr. Abney, moreover, to whom he confided his experiences at breakfast, was greatly interested and made notes of the matter in what he called his book. The spring equinox was approaching, as Mr. Abney frequently reminded his cousin, adding that this had been always considered by the ancients to be a critical time for the young, that Stephen would do well to take care of himself and to shut his bedroom window at night, and that Censorinus had some valuable remarks on the subject. Two incidents that had occurred about this time made an impression upon Stephen's mind. The first was after an unusually uneasy and depressed night that he had passed,
though he could not recall any particular dream that he had had.
The following evening, Mrs. Bunch was occupying herself in mending his nightgown.
"Gracious me, Master Stephen," she broke forth rather irritably, "how do you manage to tear your nightdress all to flinders this way? Look here, sir, what trouble you do give to poor servants that have to darn and mend for you."
There was indeed a most destructive and apparently wanton series of slits or scorings in the garment, which would undoubtedly require a skilful needle to make good. They were confined to the left side of the chest, long parallel slits about 6 inches in length, some of them not quite piercing the texture of the linen. Stephen could only express his entire ignorance of their origin. He was sure they were not there the night before.
"But," he said, "Mrs. Bunch, they are just the same as the scratches on the outside of my bedroom door, and I'm sure I never had anything to do with making them."
Mrs. Bunch gazed at him open-mouthed, then snatched up a candle, departed hastily from the room, and was heard making her way upstairs. In a few minutes she came down.
"Well," she said, "Master Stephen, it's a funny thing to me how them marks and scratches can have come there. Too high up for any cat or dog to have made 'em, much less a rat. For all the world like a Chinaman's fingernails, as my uncle in the tea trade used to tell us of when we was girls together. I wouldn't say nothing to Master, not if I was you, Master Stephen, my dear, and just turn the key of the door when you go to your bed." "I always do, Mrs. Bunch, as soon as I've said my prayers."
"Oh, that's a good child. Always say your prayers, and then no one can hurt you." Herewith Mrs. Bunch addressed herself to mending the injured nightgown, with intervals of meditation until bedtime. This was on a Friday night, in March, 1812. On the following evening, the usual duet of Stephen and Mrs. Bunch was augmented by the sudden arrival of Mr. Parkes, the butler, who as a rule kept himself rather to himself in his own pantry. He did not see that Stephen was there. He was, moreover, flustered and less slow of speech than was his wont. "Master may get his own wine if he likes of an evening," was his first remark. "Either I do it in the daytime or not at all, Mrs. Bunch. I don't know what it may be, very like it's the rats, or the wind got into the cellars, but I'm not so young as I was, and I can't go through with it as I have done." "Well, Mr. Parkes, you know it's a surprising place for the rats, is the hall?" "I'm not denying that, Mrs. Bunch, and to be sure, many a time I've heard the tale from the men in the shipyards about the rat that could speak. I never laid no confidence in that before. But tonight, if I demean myself to lay my ear to the door of the further bin, I could pretty much have heard what they were saying." "Oh, there, Mr. Parkes, I've no patience with your fancies. Rats talking in the wine cellar, indeed. Well, Mrs. Bunch, I've no wish to argue with you. All I say is, if you choose to go to the far bin and lay your ear to the door, you may prove my words this minute."
"What nonsense you do talk, Mr. Parkes.
Not fit for children to listen to. Why, you'll be frightening Master Stephen there out of his wits."
"What?"
"Master Stephen," said Parkes, awakening to the consciousness of the boy's presence. "Master Stephen knows well enough when I'm playing a joke with you, Mrs. Bunch." In fact, Master Stephen knew much too well to suppose that Mr. Parkes had in the first instance intended a joke. He was interested, not altogether pleasantly, in the situation. But all his questions were unsuccessful in inducing the butler to give any more detailed account of his experiences in the wine cellar. We have now arrived at March 24th, 1812. It was a day of curious experiences for Stephen, a windy, noisy day which filled the house and the gardens with a restless impression. As Stephen stood by the fence of the grounds and looked out into the park, he felt as if an endless procession of unseen people were sweeping past him on the wind, borne on resistlessly and aimlessly, vainly striving to stop themselves, to catch at something that might arrest their flight and bring them once again into contact with the living world of which they had formed a part. After luncheon that day, Mr. Abney said,
"Stephen, my boy, do you think you can manage to come to me tonight as late as 11 o'clock in my study? I shall be busy until that time, and I wish to show you something connected with your future life, which it is most important that you should know. You're not to mention this matter to Mrs. Bunch, nor to anyone else in the house, and you had better go to your room at the usual time." Here was a new excitement added to life. Stephen eagerly grasped at the opportunity of sitting up till 11 o'clock. He looked in at the library door on his way upstairs that evening, and saw a brazier, which he had often noticed in the corner of the room, moved out before the fire.
An old silver gilt cup stood on the table filled with red wine, and some written sheets of paper lay near it. Mr. Abney was sprinkling some incense on the brazier from a round silver box as Stephen passed, but he did not seem to notice his step. The wind had fallen, and there was a still night and a full moon. At about 10 o'clock, Stephen was standing at the open window of his bedroom, looking out over the country. Still as the night was, the mysterious population of the distant moonlit woods was not yet lulled to rest. From time to time, strange cries, as of lost and despairing wanderers, sounded from across the mere. They might be the notes of owls or water birds, yet they did not quite resemble either sound. Were not they coming nearer? Now they sounded from the nearer side of the water, and in a few moments they seemed to be floating about amongst the shrubberies. Then they ceased, but, just as Stephen was thinking of shutting the window and resuming his reading of Robinson Crusoe, he caught sight of two figures standing on the gravel terrace that ran along the garden side of the hall, the figures of a boy and girl, as it seemed. They stood side by side, looking up at the windows. Something in the form of the girl recalled irresistibly his dream of the figure in the bath. The boy inspired him with more acute fear. Whilst the girl stood still, half smiling, with her hands clasped over her heart, the boy, a thin shape with black hair and ragged clothing, raised his arms in the air with an appearance of menace and of unappeasable hunger and longing. The moon shone upon his almost transparent hands, and Stephen saw that the nails were fearfully long, and that the light shone through them. As he stood with his arms thus raised, he disclosed a terrifying spectacle. On the left side of his chest, there opened a black and gaping rent, and there fell upon Stephen's brain, rather than upon his ear, the impression of one of those hungry and desolate cries that he had heard resounding over the woods of Aswerby all that evening. In another moment this dreadful pair had moved swiftly and noiselessly over the dry gravel, and he saw them no more. Inexpressibly frightened as he was, he determined to take his candle and go down to Mr. Abney's study, for the hour appointed for their meeting was near at hand. The study, or library, opened out of the front hall on one side, and Stephen, urged on by his terrors, did not take long in getting there. To effect an entrance was not so easy. It was not locked, he felt sure, for the key was on the outside of the door as usual. His repeated knocks produced no answer. Mr. Abney was engaged. He was speaking. What? Why did he try to cry out? And why was the cry choked in his throat? Had he too seen the mysterious children? But now everything was quiet, and the door yielded to Stephen's terrified and frantic pushing. On the table in Mr. Abney's study, certain papers were found which explained the situation to Stephen Elliot when he was of an age to understand them. The most important sentences were as follows. It was a belief, very strongly and generally held by the ancients, of whose wisdom in these matters I have had such experience as induces me to place confidence in their assertions, that by enacting certain processes, which to us moderns have something of a barbaric complexion, a very remarkable enlightenment of the spiritual faculties in man may be attained, that, for example, by absorbing the personalities of a certain number of his fellow creatures, an individual may gain a complete ascendancy over those orders of spiritual beings which control the elemental forces of our universe. It is recorded of Simon Magus that he was able to fly in the air, to become invisible, or to assume any form he pleased by the agency of the soul of a boy whom, to use the libelous phrase employed by the author of Clementine Recognitions, he had murdered. I find it set down, moreover, with considerable detail, in the writings of Hermes Trismegistus, that similar, happy results may be produced by the absorption of the hearts of not less than 3 human beings below the age of 21 years.
To the testing of the truth of this receipt, I have devoted the greater part of the last 20 years, selecting as the corpora vilia of my experiments such persons as could conveniently be removed without occasioning a sensible gap in society. The first step I effected by the removal of one Phoebe Stanley, a girl of gypsy extraction, on March 24th, 1792. The second by the removal of a wandering Italian lad named Giovanni Paoli, on the night of March 23rd, 1805. The final victim, to employ a word repugnant in the highest degree to my feelings, must be my cousin, Stephen Elliot. His day must be March 24th, 1812. The best means of effecting the required absorption is to remove the heart from the living subject, to reduce it to ashes, and to mingle them with about a pint of some red wine, preferably port. The remains of the first two subjects, at least, it will be well to conceal. A disused bathroom or wine cellar will be found convenient for such a purpose. Some annoyance may be experienced from the psychic portion of the subjects, which popular language dignifies with the name of ghosts. But the man of philosophic temperament, to whom alone the experiment is appropriate, will be little prone to attach importance to the feeble efforts of these beings to wreak their vengeance on him. I contemplate with the liveliest satisfaction the enlarged and emancipated existence which the experiment, if successful, will confer on me, not only placing me beyond the reach of human justice, so-called, but eliminating to a great extent the prospect of death itself.
Mr. Abney was found in his chair, his head thrown back, his face stamped with an expression of rage, fright, and mortal pain. In his left side was a terrible lacerated wound exposing the heart. There was no blood on his hands, and a long knife that lay on the table was perfectly clean. A savage wildcat might have inflicted the injuries. The window of the study was open, and it was the opinion of the coroner that Mr. Abney had met his death by the agency of some wild creature. But Stephen Elliott's study of the papers I have quoted led him to a very different conclusion.
All right, that concludes our episode. If you would like to comment on the story in this episode, please email me at feedback@moreghoststories.com. Next, if you enjoy More Ghost Stories, please help us grow the community by letting your friends and family know. It's easy to do that by going to the www.moreghoststories.com website and locating the story that you want to hear on the front page and pressing play. It's that simple. This concludes the show. Thank you for listening. I'm J.B. Simeon, and I'll see you next week with a new episode. Until then, be aware, be cautious, and take care.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.